From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, legalized bribery and congressional campaigns. We talk with liberal consumer advocate Ralph Nader and conservative strategist Paul Weyrich, who agree on at least one issue, that money from lobbyists and special interest groups corrupts American politics. Also, the Weinberger Notes. What more do they say about Bush's knowledge of the Arms for Hostages deal? We talk with senior analyst Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive about Oval Office meeting notes released last Friday, written by former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger during the height of the Arms for Hostages deal. That and more on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush stops in six states today, critical to his reelection bid. In New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, Mr. Bush continued to attack the character of his opponent, whom he describes as too slick for the Oval Office. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from Akron, Ohio.
Publicly confident of a come-from-behind victory, President Bush promised a crowd in a largely Republican Philadelphia suburb that he would deliver the greatest political comeback in history. His pollster, Robert Teeter, said such a comeback would require the president to win traditionally Republican southern and western states, and in addition, a handful of big Midwestern industrial states. Teeter says he's confident Mr. Bush clearly has the lead in 15 core states. A third of the states are in play, Teeter said. Asked whether he's told the president there's a possibility he could lose, Teeter said no. I tell him several times a day how he's going to do it. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Akron.
Democrat Al Gore scheduled campaign stops in seven states today, states that the Democratic campaign considers essential for victory or where the race is particularly close. He began the day with a rally in downtown Raleigh, North Carolina, one of the states that's considered a potential toss-up. The day continued with a string of airport rallies in Georgia, Tennessee, Ohio, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Kansas. Georgia is among the states that are regarded as close. Ohio and Wisconsin are among those that are considered essential to win. Gore used a series of satellite television interviews to attack what he called the outright false, scurrilous advertising of the Bush campaign. At his rallies, he pressed the campaign's theme of uniting America. Irvin Magic Johnson has decided to end his brief return to pro basketball, saying he cannot play and devote time to his family and AIDS education. Nick Roman reports.
Johnson says his decision to return to retirement came after consulting his wife, Cookie. A statement released by the Lakers star says he needs to cope with the larger issue of living with HIV. Fresh from the Olympics, Johnson played in five of the Lakers' preseason games. He appeared to have lost none of his skills after skipping all of last season. But Johnson also spent the last month denying claims he'd contracted the AIDS virus through homosexual sex. He also fueled controversy by quitting the president's AIDS commission and announcing his support for Bill Clinton. There's no word about what happens to his $15 million Laker contract, the biggest in pro team sports. For National Public Radio, I'm Nick Roman in Los Angeles.
Stock prices closed sharply higher today on Wall Street. Analysts said that trading was relatively quiet as investors waited for developments in the presidential campaign. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 36 points to close at 3,262. Advances led declines by a margin of almost 2-1. This is NPR. Liberian rebels continued to shell Monrovia today as Roman Catholic leaders held a requiem mass for five American nuns who were killed last week. The Archbishop of Monrovia condemned rebel leader Charles Taylor for the attacks on the city and for the killings of the nuns. Taylor has denied responsibility for the slayings, blaming them on rival factions. Taylor began his attack on the city about 2 weeks ago, apparently because he felt pressured by a new rebel group. Observers say that Taylor probably doesn't have the firepower to defeat the 12,000 West African peacekeepers who are guarding the city, but he could keep up his rocket and sniper attacks. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has declared a month-long state of emergency in the southern Russian regions of North Ossetia and Ingushetia following a weekend of violent clashes between the ethnic groups. The BBC's Bridget Kendall reports.
For the last few few months, President Yeltsin had already been under some considerable pressure from conservative politicians to impose a state of emergency along Russia's volatile southern border with the Caucasus. The concern then was that the dispute between Georgia and Abkhazia could spread north to engulf southern Russia as well. This latest outbreak of fighting between the Ingush and the Ossetians is in fact about a separate territorial claim. Nonetheless, it's clearly a clash that has greatly alarmed Moscow. And President Yeltsin's decision to impose a special temporary administration over the two regions, headed by a deputy Russian prime minister, is no doubt in order to prevent a local dispute escalating into a larger war.
The BBC's Bridget Kendall. Relief officials in Somalia said today that their efforts are threatened by renewed fighting among the nation's clans. Aid workers say there have been skirmishes in at least two towns that have served as distribution centers for relief supplies. They say they fear that large-scale fighting could erupt again. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you can't raise several million dollars, you probably won't win a seat in Congress. And once elected, a typical U.S. senator needs to raise $12,000 a week to have enough money to run for his or her next election. The corrupting influence of all that money has gotten two political foes, liberal consumer advocate Ralph Nader and conservative political strategist Paul Weyrich, to join together to advocate campaign financing reforms. They're carrying on a fight begun by Philip Stern, who had been railing for years against the influence of money in Congress before his death this past June. An updated edition of Stern's 1988 book, The Best Congress Money Can Buy, has just been published. Still, The Best Congress Money Can Buy details how political action committees and wealthy individual campaign contributors have been circumventing laws designed to control and limit the flow of money to members of Congress. Ralph Nader is seen as the father of the consumer movement in this country. He first took on the auto industry in the mid-60s with his book Unsafe at Any Speed. Paul Weyrich is one of the leading new right political strategists and helped to put together the Moral Majority and the Heritage Foundation. I asked Ralph Nader to explain the current rules that govern how much money a PAC can spend on a political campaign.
$5,000 for the primary and then $5,000 for the general election. So it's a $10,000 limit, and that's what the political action committees mean when they say they've packed out on a candidate. But of course, individuals can give $1,000 in the primary, $1,000 for the general election. And that means that the PACs are increasingly at an advantage. The PACs are technically corporations. So corporations can give more than individuals. And since there are 4,500 political action committees, at least, registered with the Federal Election Commission, you can see how the candidate would, whether a challenger or incumbent, would begin to tailor what they say when they're interviewed by these PACs prior to getting their check. These PACs actually interview candidates, and the bulk of the PAC money goes to the incumbents. They don't take their chances very often with challengers.
How, though, are PACs able to get around the laws that put these monetary limits on campaign contributions?
Well, there are two different groups, for example, that give a substantial amount of money at one time, the unions and, for example, the Israeli lobby. And both of these have multiple PACs. And then the word sort of goes out from one of the major PACs that interviews, and all the other PACs follow. You can just trace when a certain contribution comes in from one of the PACs, and then within a week or two, 15, 20, 30, up to 70 or 80 different PACs will contribute to a candidate. They do that, and then they also do something which is called bundling. That is, they ask people on their list to contribute to a candidate, to send the campaign contribution to them, and then they bundle up these contributions and they send the $1,000 contributions or less to the campaigns. But of course, it is very clear who it was that raised this money for them, and so that exceeds the law in the technical sense that a particular PAC might send a candidate $1,000 contributions at a single time.
What's interesting and pointed out in Phil Stern's new book, Still the Best Money, the Best Congress Money Can Buy, is the investment return for these PACs and these financial contributions. AT&T put about $1.5 million in congressional campaigns between 1979 and 1986 and got a $12 billion set of tax benefits in return. And he points out that General Electric and other companies are really witnesses to what Will Rogers said when he described Congress back in the 1930s as the best money can buy. So you have the oil PACs and the textile PACs and the doctor PACs and the auto dealer PACs and even the chicken coop manufacturer PACs, all zeroing in on key members of key committees from which they want certain goodies, whether it's an investment credit or suppression of a particular bill that they find unfriendly to them, or passage of a bill, or a particular corporate subsidy that's part of the corporate welfare programs that proliferate in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, so the unions do precisely the same thing.
They don't seem to be getting as much, it's, though.
they have maintained their position, basically, through a hostile administration, an administration that wanted to curb their power but was unable to do so because of the influence that they have, for example, with the various labor committees in both the House and Senate, where the members of those committees are wholly owned subsidiaries of the unions.
But is there a cause and effect? And can you prove that because a PAC gave certain money to a particular congressperson, that that congressperson then changed their mind and voted in support of the PAC?
Not only cause and effect, but many members admit it. In a series of interviews pointed out in Phil Stern's book, one-fifth of them actually admitted it openly. And as you know, this is not something which is usually admitted. One good example is the Federal Trade Commission was going to issue a rule based on a decency towards one neighbor, which would have required used car dealers to tell prospective purchasers about known defects in the car they were about to buy. It didn't require the used car dealer to inspect or do anything like that, just if they knew. And the Car Dealers Association has opposed this, poured money into Congress, and got a bill overruling the Federal Trade Commission. So this happens all the time, whether it's blocking legislation or overruling agency decisions or getting, and most likely it's getting these tax benefits, getting these subsidy programs through Congress, or getting legitimizing of certain government contracts that are being steered toward certain corporations.
We had a famous instance a few years ago of an amendment which passed the Congress by a 2-to-1 margin, which was actually a sort of nationalist anti-foreign aid amendment, but it would have affected the banks. And the banks got to work, and within 48 hours, they reversed that vote and got a 2-to-1 in the other direction. And if you look at who switched, there is no question but what these banks weighed in with those people that they had supported.
Also, these contributions are keyed to the committees that the legislation comes out of. For example, it's no coincidence that the bank PACs focus heavily on the House Banking Committee and the Senate Banking Committee in terms of who they give their money to.
Well, as a matter of fact, members fight over committee designations because they say, well, if we get on this PAC, on this committee, it is so much easier to raise money from PACs as opposed to, say, the Foreign Relations Committee, where it is much more difficult to raise money because the PACs don't care about it. But if you're on the Commerce Committee or if you're on the Banking Committee or you're on the Appropriations Committee, oh, boy, that is considered lucrative. And so the Committee on Committees that works these things actually get pressure from members based on what kind of money they can raise for their campaigns rather than looking at the good of the country and what kind of public service they can do by being members of these committees.
How, though, do PACs target particular members of Congress?
Well, I don't think it's very difficult. They watch who gets on the committees, and in some cases they even assist people getting on the committees. And once these people are on the committees, where the committees relate to their business, they go after these people, and they put enormous pressure on them. And the way the members have to begin raising money the minute they get elected, if a particular set of PACs makes it easier for the member to raise money and to get money in the Treasury, they will manage to I think, have quite an impact because the member is very grateful. Most members don't like to have to raise money, and so the members are very grateful to those PACs which say, look, we'll host a fundraiser for you. And then they get all of their employees and they get other people in the associations and so on to come to these fundraisers. And the guy may walk away with $100,000 in one crack just by going to a reception for an hour and a half. And, you know, when the person who put this together comes calling on the member of Congress, I can assure you, as somebody who worked for two members of the Senate leadership, that they get in.
And you know what else is important is to describe the intensity of the flow of the funds. There are some senators who raise $10,000 to $20,000 a week, 50 weeks a year, for 6 years to get their campaign kitty up to the $6, $7 million level. And there are members of Congress that have to of the House who raise $5,000 a week, or something on that order. So there are constant absorption of time by the members of Congress, always on the phone, always having lunch, always currying the favor of people who can give them money or cause money to be given to them. Meanwhile, average citizen groups, people who just want to discuss substantive issues, want to discuss the great questions and the small questions of a political democracy, can hardly get into the door to see a senator or representative. They're lucky if they see a senatorial or representative aide because they haven't paid the ticket of admission.
But what is wrong with an organization, whether it's a PAC or not, but let's call it a PAC, supporting a candidate who believes what they do? Let's say the NRA is supporting a particular candidate that believes in the values of the NRA. Is there anything wrong with that?
Well, yes, because it puts money as the supreme determiner or shaper of what legislators do instead of their beliefs and the beliefs of their constituents. It also puts to a great disadvantage the millions of Americans who only have their vote to influence their member of Congress. And I've always believed that your vote should be nullified only by someone who's voting against you, not by someone who can write a $5,000 check to an incumbent or challenger.
Well, there I would have some disagreement with Ralph. I don't have a problem with the so-called issue-oriented or ideological PACs, which actually stand for something on both ends of the political spectrum, because I think that is part of the American political process. And in that sense, the PACs can act as mutual funds for people out there who wouldn't know which candidates to support because of their position on issues. What I have a big problem with are all the vast majority of the political action committees who stand for nothing other than their particular special interest and who then, will give to any candidate that will agree in effect, be responsive to them, and particularly incumbents who will work on these incumbents until they get what they want. And the rest of the incumbents' voting record can cancel out that position as long as they're responsive to that particular group.
I'm speaking with consumer advocate Ralph Nader and conservative Paul Weyrich, who have joined forces to argue for congressional election finance reform. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Ralph Nader and Paul Weyrich about the corrupting influence of campaign financing for congressional candidates. Do the two main parties, the Democratic and Republican parties, are they interested in controlling or limiting the control of PACs?
Well, no. I think both parties have encouraged the development of PACs. And as a matter of fact, they sort of threaten PACs now if they don't give to their candidates that they're going to pass legislation. So the game now has been to come in and say, well, you know, we've been supporters of PACs, but if you don't give to our candidates in this election cycle, we'll do you in. And so then the PACs begin to reshuffle who it is they contribute to. So both political parties have played this game. And as a matter of fact, you'll notice that PAC legislation alternately passes the Senate and the House, but never both. And the reason is because it's a sort of game that is played between the leadership of the Congress not to pass legislation, but to make sure that they can get a vote in one House or another so that the senator or congressman can go back and say, oh, yes, when the issue came up, I voted right. But in point of fact, the legislation never manages to pass.
Except this year, a campaign finance bill did pass that limited how much members could receive from PACs, but it was vetoed by President Bush.
On what grounds?
On the grounds that it favored incumbents, which is the usual argument that all incumbents who don't want campaign finance reform give, because it makes them look good. But there are so many different versions of reform on Capitol Hill, but the momentum is toward reform compared to a few years ago. The question is, what kind of reform? How far does it go?
And yet incumbent is a dirty word in this election, and it looks as if you can believe the pollsters and whoever, that there are going to be a lot of new people in Congress. These are outsiders. Do you think they're going to championing this cause, or do you think once they get on the inside, they're going to want the same deal that incumbents have had?
If we can get some kind of action in the first 6 months of the new Congress, there is an opportunity to do something. If it goes beyond that, the same forces will begin to take control as they have with so many of these other people, because it's the path of least resistance. The reason that incumbents, by the way, are having a problem this time isn't because of this. It is because of the bank scandals and the restaurant scandal and the post office scandal and all of these things, which
the pay grab
and the perks and so on, which were brought to the public's attention, in some cases by us, by the way, in opposition to both political parties. And so the public is fed up, but this has not become an issue.
And yet, certainly Watergate brought in financial reform in presidential campaigns. Why, for instance, didn't something like the SNL crisis do the same thing for Congress?
Well, that's a very good question. And people who do want reform of these campaign finance scandals are saying that the least that could occur is to have the same process that applies to post-primary presidential candidacies, say between Bush and Clinton, where they're given a choice. They either can take private money or not take money from the checkoff on the 1040 tax return, or if they take money from the public, they can't take private money. And one recommendation is, well, why don't you apply that to congressional races, at least for a start?
And is that something that you would support, Ralph Nader?
Yes, it certainly is a start. I mean, either the citizens are going to fund our political campaigns, or the auto, oil, medical lobby, and all the other lobbies are going to do so, the banks, the insurance companies. That's our choice. And it's really the best investment citizens can make, especially if it's on a well-promoted voluntary checkoff on the 1040 return, because the total every 2 year tab for congressional elections is less than $500 million every 2 years, which is about half the price of one B-2 bomber. And if we can fund these campaigns, then the telephone companies and the electric companies and the oil companies won't be investing $1 million, $2 million in Congress and getting billions of dollars of subsidies and tax benefits and other goodies in return.
Paul Ryrick, would you agree with that? And it sounds like what you're saying, Ralph Nader, is that you would be for complete public financing of congressional campaigns.
Well, you can't do that under the Supreme Court. What you can do is give the candidates a choice. If they choose to take the public financing, they can't take private money. And if they don't, if they do take private money, then they're not going to get any public financing.
Yeah, as long as that option is kept open, I think it ought to be looked at. I don't think we ever want to exclude somebody from coming in the way that Perot has, whether you support him or don't support him. I fear a system where people are locked out and locked into a system where nobody can get around it. So as long as people are given that option, where if incumbents just get entrenched, that somebody in fact can come around and spend their own money or raise private money to do it, I think that ought to be looked at. I also think, though, that we have to link it with reform of the perks that they get, because otherwise you will have a situation where if somebody takes money, it'll be limited because the corollary to taking money is that there's a cap on what federal money is spent. And if the perks are not curbed, then the incumbents are really going to have a great advantage because nobody will be able to raise enough money to overcome the $2 million a year that they spend on, in effect, their own reelection once they get in.
To be specific, Paul's referring to, they have their own TV studios and radio studios in Congress. They use the franking privilege to send millions of letters out, and too many of them use existing staff around election time to go out and help reelect themselves.
These guys have mobile units with their names printed in big letters. They got enough staff to the point where out in the district, some of these members of Congress have more franchise offices than McDonald's, you know, in their district. I mean, you can run into one in your neighborhood.
I don't know if this is a fair characterization, but I see you, Ralph Nader, and you, Paul Weyrich, as opposite ends of the political spectrum. Do you find yourselves surprised to be in agreement on this issue?
Yes and no. We are in more and more agreement on more and more of these institutional questions because politics is becoming less liberal versus conservative and more establishment versus anti-establishment. And neither one of us represents the establishment. And both of us coming from our opposite ends of the political spectrum, I think, see the same appalling things. We may occasionally have different remedies, but I think that we have observed the same things in the political life of this country.
Ralph Nader?
I'd agree with that.
Well, Jerry Falwell actually called you, Paul Weyrich, the Ralph Nader of our cause. This was about 10 years ago. What do you think about that?
Well, I was complimented because one thing about Ralph is that, A, he is a serious person, and, B, he's not a fraud. That is to say, he lives the views that he expresses. And in that sense, I don't mind being compared to him. Quite the contrary, I'm honored. Because he is, whatever you say about him, and we certainly disagree on a variety of issues, but he's not a phony. And this city is so laden with phonies that, frankly, he's a breath of fresh air from time to time.
Paul Weyrich, how do you think George Bush has done in this campaign as a leader of the Republican Party?
Well, I don't think very well because he has failed to lay out a vision of where he wants to take the country. And I think that's one of the reasons he's in political trouble, because those people who are interested in the future, and elections by and large are about the future, have not been attracted to him the way they were to Ronald Reagan, because they haven't heard anything, and they know in many cases the country is in trouble, and he really doesn't acknowledge that. In fact, he suggests that those of us that say things are in decline are wrong. Well, I'm afraid that people understand inherently that things are in decline, and they're looking for the candidate that addresses that.
And Ralph Nader, what is your take on the Democratic Party's move to the middle, move to a more conservative agenda?
Well, it's hard to differentiate now, increasingly, Republicans and Democrats. George Bush made a very interesting statement a few weeks ago, and he said, Bill Clinton sounds too much like me. I think that's a very telling commentary on the increasing convergence of the Democratic and Republican parties to favor the interests whose strings are being pulled by this big money that we've been discussing. I think the first and fundamental measure of any politician running for office in this country is the degree to which he or she is going to emphasize strengthening the tools of democracy for millions of Americans in their respective roles as voters, taxpayers, workers, consumers, and shareholders. That's where the real change will come from, as it has in our history, bottom up.
Consumer advocate Ralph Nader and conservative political strategist Paul Weyrich are working together to advocate for the financial reform of congressional campaigns. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on special election assignment. Some people are calling the Casper Weinberger notes released last Friday the smoking gun that could implicate President Bush in the arms for hostages deal. Was he in the loop? Coming up, we look at what the notes said and what they mean with Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst at the National Security Archive. And John Leonard reviews a new book by Carl Sagan and Andruyan called Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Both President Bush and Governor Bill Clinton continue their multi-state campaigning on this last day of the 1992 election campaign. Clinton's three-plane caravan landed in St. Louis, Missouri, where he spoke to supporters at an airport rally. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from St. Louis.
Clinton has been working his way west, hitting key battleground states along the way. He began in Philadelphia this morning, then made stops in Ohio and Michigan. Clinton's voice has been hoarse and raw, but as the day goes on, it's getting stronger, and his speech is getting a little longer. By the time he spoke to thousands of screaming supporters in St. Louis, he had returned to taking defensive jabs at George Bush.
Every time my opponent has come here, he's made up the same old stories about tax and spend. Every time he comes here, it's more false charges. And every time those charges have been made, the major newspapers in America, the networks who have analyzed the veracity of his ads, have said, this guy is not telling the truth about Clinton's record or Clinton's program.
From St. Louis, he heads to Kentucky, Texas, and New Mexico, ending with a dawn rally in Denver. In St. Louis, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Bush is on a campaign swing through half a dozen states before he heads to Texas, where he votes tomorrow. Once again, Mr. Bush is predicting victory tomorrow, proving, he says, the pollster's wrong. White House Chief of Staff James Baker told reporters that the race is pretty much going their way. The president told campaign rallies that the question confronting voters is who do they trust with their families and with the future of the nation. And in Philadelphia, the president predicted one of the biggest surprises in political history. UN officials in Bosnia have warned that hundreds of thousands of people could die this winter because all three warring factions, Serbians, Croatians, and Muslims, are hindering aid efforts. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Belgrade.
UN High Commission for Refugees Special Representative Jose Maria Mendeluce said all combatants must show a little goodwill, otherwise they will all be responsible for the human tragedy. Aid workers say hundreds of thousands of people could die in Bosnia due to lack of medicine, food, and shelter. UNHCR today began delivery of thousands of blankets, tents, clothing packages, and food destined for Travnik, where thousands of refugees are congregating after nearby Jajce fell to Serb forces. Mendeluce said relief convoys have been delayed by Croat, Serb, and Muslim forces at their different checkpoints, where fighters try to show their authority by searching for contraband. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 36 points to close at 3,261.21 on volume of 202 million shares. This is NPR News. According to the government, construction spending last month had its biggest advance in 5 months. With mortgage rates at 19-year lows, the Commerce Department says construction spending expanded by 1.3%. Overall, private sector construction was up more than 1%, and public construction was up more than 2%. In Liberia, heavy shelling continues as troops led by rebel leader Charles Taylor lay siege to a West African peacekeeping force in the capital city. NPR's Suni Khalid reports that local Roman Catholic leaders have blamed Taylor for the murders of five American nuns over the weekend.
Monrovia's Archbishop Michael Francis today held a requiem mass for five murdered American nuns. The nuns, from an Illinois order, worked as teachers and nurses at a local high school in Monrovia and were killed near their convent near the Capitol in an area controlled by rebel leader Charles Taylor. The Archbishop said he held Taylor personally responsible for the murders and appealed to him to allow the bodies of the nuns to be retrieved for burial. The United States and Pope John Paul II also condemned the murders. Taylor has denied that he is to blame for the deaths of the nuns. They are the latest of an estimated 20,000 people to die in Liberia's three-year civil war. Meanwhile, Taylor's forces stepped up artillery attacks on downtown Monrovia. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
According to news reports in Beirut, Syria and Russia have made an arms agreement under which Syria will get Russian-built planes, tanks, and anti-missile systems. According to a published report, this agreement was reached earlier this year as part of a $2 billion weapons accord signed in 1991. Interest on U.S. savings bonds has fallen to its lowest point since the onset of variable rate bonds 10 years ago. The government says that new savings bonds will earn interest at a rate of 5.04%. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A new indictment against former Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger has revealed evidence that casts doubt on President George Bush's role in the Iran-Contra scandal when he was vice president. Bush has maintained that he was out of the loop when arms for hostages were discussed in the Reagan administration. But a handwritten note made by Caspar Weinberger after a White House meeting held on January 7, 1986, indicates otherwise. This note was obtained by Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh and made public this past Friday. It reveals that at that January 7th meeting, President Reagan agreed to sell 4,000 TOW anti-tank missiles to Iran in exchange for the release of five American hostages. According to Weinberger, he and then-Secretary of State George Shultz opposed this policy. Quote, Bill Casey, Ed Meese, and VP favored, and so did Poindexter. We decided to call Peter Kornbluh at the National Security Archive to ask him about this recently released note. He's a senior analyst at the archive, which is privately run. They've been gathering documents on Iran-Contra through the Freedom of Information Act. He said this note is not new information. So I asked him why the press is treating it like it is.
It makes two things very clear. One, that Bush was quite aware that we were explicitly trading arms for hostages. And two, that he was there when Caspar Weinberger and George Shultz forcefully opposed this trade. This contradicts numerous statements that he has made to the press, and even in his own autobiography in 1987, where he noted that George Shultz and Cap Weinberger had serious doubts, too, as it turned out. If I had known that and asked the president to call a meeting, he might have seen the project in a different light.
Well, does it say that, President Bush was in the loop, not outside it, as he has contended in the past?
I think the importance of the note is it reinforces dramatically evidence that we have had all along that not only was George Bush in the loop, but he was in the room. He was in the room when opposition to this policy was made quite clear when the back and forth, the discussion about what this policy really was, how explicitly it was trading arms for hostages. This note goes beyond other documents that we have because it says quite clearly we're trading five hostages for 4,000 missiles. That's unmistakable, and I doubt that unless George Bush had fallen asleep during this meeting that he could have mistaken it for anything but direct trading, swapping, ransoming hostages with U.S. military weapons.
Well, let me ask you about something, and I'm going to be quoting here from Larry King Live on Friday when President Bush was his guest, and President Bush said, in response to this Caspar Weinberger memo, to this very day, President Reagan didn't feel that that arrangement was arms for hostages. I said I supported the President of the United States. I've testified to that. And if that was Caspar Weinberger's opinion, fine, go ask President Reagan if he thought it was arms for hostages, and he'd say no. Now, you're saying that President Reagan knew clear well it was arms for hostages.
At the time, he did. And, the famous saying out of Watergate was, what did the president know and when did he know it? And unfortunately, out of Iran-Contra with President Reagan, the saying became, what did he know and when did he forget it? The problem with Ronald Reagan is that even though the contemporary documentation shows that he knew at the time, later he would say that he knew or that he forgot or that he didn't know. And it was never clear. He told the Tower Commission three different versions of whether he had authorized or not, or had forgotten about these early shipments of arms. But the documentation shows, beyond a doubt, that he did know. I think one of the problems with the Iran-Contra scandal is that the important U.S. policymakers involved have tripped over their own cover stories. Ronald Reagan put out this story after it became clear that we had sent arms to Iran and traded them for hostages. He put out the story that, he didn't really understand that. As I recall, in March of 1987, when we finally broke down and apologized to the American public, he said, you know, my heart tells me we weren't trading arms for hostages, but the facts tell me otherwise. Now Bush wants us to return to that earlier story, and it just isn't so. The documentation is too overwhelming at this point for us to accept that story.
So when President Bush says that he basically supported the president being Ronald Reagan, and the president said he didn't think it was arms for hostages, what is President Bush saying? What is he trying to say?
Well, I must say I think he's trying to muddle the issue. And to muddle his own role, just as Ronald Reagan tried to obfuscate his own role in this whole dynamic. There is evidence that Reagan had some idea that that indeed the arms were going to, quote, moderate elements of the Iranian army, and that that would help foment a coup in Iran, moderates against the radicals. But what the notes, Weinberger's notes also show is that he disabused the president of this. And later on in other meetings, the discussion of the transaction was explicit. We are giving X amount of arms for X amount of hostages. And even later on, as you know, Bush went to Israel and was briefed by an Israeli operative, Admiral Nir, in July of 1986, who explicitly told him, we're not dealing with moderates in Iran. We're dealing with radicals. And the reason we're dealing with them is because they're the only ones that have the power to get these hostages released.
I'm speaking with Peter Kornbluh, and he's a senior analyst with the National Security Archive. And we're talking about notes that were revealed last Friday, notes taken by Caspar Weinberger about a meeting held in January 7th, 1986, which seemed to point to the fact that President Bush was in on a meeting in which arms for hostages were discussed. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Peter Kornbluh, who's the senior analyst with the National Security Archive. Do you think there's something politically motivated about the timing of this letter, this Caspar Weinberger's note on Friday, of course, just a couple days before the election?
I really don't think so. I think you'd have to remember the history of the Weinberger case. The Weinberger case was originally scheduled to go to trial today, of all days, one day before the election, which obviously would have been a very interesting set of circumstances if evidence like this was being released in opening arguments, for example, on the day before the election. That date was set by a judge. The independent counsel had nothing to do with it. It was because of the Clark Clifford case and Robert Altman case with BCCI, the bank scandal, and the fact that, the firm that was representing Weinberger and Clifford and Altman was the same firm, that the case then got moved from November 2nd to January 5th. The other circumstance of import was that the judge in the Weinberger case threw out the first count of obstruction of Congress, and Lawrence Walsh was forced to rewrite that count, making it a withholding information from Congress and issuing a new indictment. Had the judge not thrown out that initial count, we never would have had this new indictment at this time, and we certainly wouldn't have had access to Weinberger's notes now.
How was Lawrence Walsh, the independent prosecutor, able to get Weinberger's notes?
What happened was Weinberger was asked repeatedly in 1987 and again in later in 1989, first in 1987 by the congressional investigators, and then in 1989 by the Office of the Independent Counsel, whether he had contemporaneous notes or a diary or anything that would help him refresh his memories of the various meetings he was in. He went out of his way to deny that he had such notes, even saying that he wished that he had been like Henry Kissinger, who took copious notes of all of his meetings and then was able to write his comprehensive memoirs. As Weinberger put it, you know, when I left a meeting, I didn't take copious notes, I went to another meeting. And so he denied that he had these notes. Then he quietly took several thousand pages of contemporaneous notes that he had taken on most of his telephone calls, on most of the meetings that he had attended, and he deposited them in the Library of Congress with what I believe was a 10-year deed. That is, that nobody but Weinberger could have access to them for 10 years. Somebody in Weinberger's office in 1990 told the Independent Counsel that this is what had happened and that Weinberger had deceived the Independent Counsel by saying he had no such notes. The Independent Counsel, I guess with a subpoena, got access to those notes, and just discovering that cache of documentation allowed the Independent Counsel to charge Weinberger with perjury, obstruction of justice, by withholding relevant evidence in the Iran-Contra scandal.
Were any laws broken regarding the trading of arms for hostages?
Well, there were a number of laws that came to bear here. The first one was the Arms Export Act, which is a law that states that you have to notify Congress about certain weapons that are sent abroad. Weinberger told Reagan this on December 7th, 1985. According to Weinberger's notes, he said to Reagan, "I argue strongly that we have an embargo that makes arms sales to Iran illegal, and President couldn't violate it, that washing the transaction through Israel wouldn't make it legal. Schultz and Don Regan agreed. President said he could answer charges of illegality, but he couldn't answer charge that, quote, big, strong President Reagan passed up a chance to free hostages, unquote." The president then left to do his radio interview. But there were other laws, and the most important one deals with these shipments that went through Israel in the fall of 1985. Under the Intelligence Reform Act of 1980, the president must present Congress with a finding for every covert operation that takes place. And here was a covert operation that had no finding.
So when then-President Ronald Reagan went to the American people and stated the administration's policy of refusing to bargain for the hostages, was he lying?
He was indeed, because he had been bargaining for hostages all along. Now, it's not a crime to lie or deceive the American public. So President Reagan, or President Bush for that matter, can say false things on radio and television and to reporters. It is a crime, however, to mislead Congress and to deceive federal investigators. And this is the reason why, at one point, the Independent Counsel was considering going for an indictment against Ronald Reagan.
Hostages, of course, are such an emotional issue, and I wonder whether it's hard to gauge how the public actually feels about something, but whether, when it comes down to it, the American people wanted the hostages out and they really didn't care about the methods.
Well, I wonder about that, too. And if Ronald Reagan had believed that, he could have simply stood up on the first day that this story broke and said, this is what I did and this is why I did it. Or he could have even publicly announced that this is what he was going to do and asked for the laws to be changed. The problem is twofold. One, he would have been explicitly contradicting his own campaign platform, "We will not negotiate with terrorists." And two, he would have been acknowledging that he had violated the law on reporting to Congress on covert operations. And that, I think, is the real issue that forced the cover-up, that forced this to be kept secret and for the president and his men to scurry around, try and build a cover story and stick with that story and all its variants, even as more and more information came out, making that story totally totally incomprehensible and unbelievable.
This doesn't seem to be an issue of huge importance to the American people. Why is it an important issue, do you think?
I think that this issue is more important to the American people than the question suggests. If it wasn't so important, every time significant new evidence on Iran-Contra and on officials who are currently in government and their role in Iran-Contra came out, the press wouldn't give it the front page attention that it has received. It was an important scandal of the 1980s. It rivaled Watergate in its importance. The reason why it's so important is because the Iran-Contra scandal represented a threat to our constitutional system of governance. It represented a president and men around him deliberately circumventing the will of Congress in terms of raising funds from elsewhere outside the country to support policies that Congress had cut off funding for. And it represented a failure of the public trust. It represented a clear contradiction of the explicit policy of not negotiating with terrorists that Ronald Reagan had campaigned on in 1980 and essentially been elected on, if you remember, because of the Iran crisis with our hostages at the U.S. Embassy. All these things, I think, combined to make it a very, very important scandal and one that is not yet over because we have not yet learned the full story of this scandal, largely because of efforts by people still in government to obstruct our ability to get the documentation, to get the information. Maybe after tomorrow's election, the situation will be different and we'll have easier access to that information and we'll finally be able to lay the scandal to rest.
Peter Kornbluh, thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Thank you. Peter Kornbluh is a senior analyst at the National Security Archive. This is Fresh Air. Lynn Neary has joined us to tell us about all things considered today. And I guess, Lynn, you'll be talking a lot about the election.
That's right. We'll have a lot of politics on the show tonight, Marty. We'll be checking in with our reporters who have been following the three major candidates. We'll be trying to find out what the mood is in the three campaigns on this day before Election Day. And we'll have reports on the congressional races, where they're expecting to see some changes, particularly in the House of Representatives. We'll also have a conversation with author Susan Miner, whose new book is Folly, and she'll be talking about that.
Okay, Lynn, those stories and more are coming up later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Carl Sagan and his wife, Ann Druyan, have just come out with a new book, Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors. John Leonard has this review.
Astronomer Carl Sagan and his novelist wife, Ann Druyan, who gave us the Cosmos series on public television, have teamed up again to tell us all they know about human identity and our intimate circle of kinship with every other species on the planet. Because they want us to stop hurting the ecosystem, they think we should realize just how lucky we are to be around in the first place. This is the fun part of Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors. Ransacking the various sciences, the Sagans portray Homo sap as a child of dust and chaos, of fluid dynamics and random chance. Our planethood itself is fortuitous. Think of all the other rogue worldlets that perished in the interstellar night. And then, for what seems like forever, we just sat there, waiting for an accidental energizer, a bolt of cosmic radiation to roil the waters of the primordial earth soup and form the first self-replicating molecules. After which, for 4 billion years, it was trial and error, hit and miss. Natural selection is very slow. An occasional cataclysm helps shuffle our genetic deck. For instance, the asteroidal wham-bang 65 million years ago that ruined the neighborhood for dinosaurs, although bivalves and sponges did okay. And so does sex help, invented late in the evolutionary game, but a far more agreeable way of recombining DNAs than playing cosmic collision roulette with stray comets and angry volcanoes. After sex came a brain for data processing and pattern recognition, although the Sagans give short shrift to neuroanatomy, as they do to paleontology, because they're too busy leaping in a single bound from Darwin to Jane Goodall, looking down at ticks, caterpillars, honeybees, Syrian hamsters, and Norway rats, to get to the chimpanzee. In every important respect, we're told, man and chimp are as close as horses and donkeys, and closer than turkeys and chickens, or camels and llamas. And this is where Shadows gets problematic. The Sagans feel they have to prove that Homo sap in no way differs significantly from any other primate. Worse, they believe they have proved it. You want tools, language, play, ethics, art, abstraction, cannibalism, or female orgasm, and they will find something that looks like it somewhere in the animal kingdom, according to the crudest and often even most laughable definitions. As if, at some point, differences in degree don't become differences in kind. As if an accidental byproduct of big braininess weren't an obsession with death. As if the finger painting of a chimp were the equivalent of the cathedral at Chartres. As if Mozart and Immanuel Kant were ever in helpless heat. As if King Kong or Dumbo ever thought metaphorically. As if any other animal had ever written a book like Shadows, hoping to change the mind of an entire species, the only species that thinks about killing off all the rest of them for entertainment purposes. By the way, I spoke to God on this subject. In addition to being androgynous, God has call waiting. I asked God how God felt about being left out of the Democratic Party platform, the United States Constitution, and Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors. God hit me with a whirlwind. But while I had God on the phone, I also wanted to know how God intended to vote. Well, God, like everybody else, is worried about the economy. After all, God is out of work.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Fresh Air's engineers this week are Audrey Vablaitis, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Kezia Perlman is our intern. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Marty Moscowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how the media did this time on the presidential campaign trail. We talk with political reporter and media columnist for Newsweek, Jonathan Alter. And Eric Larson of The Wall Street Journal fills us in on the problem with polls. I'm Marty Moscowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.